Welcome to Character Explorations, a podcast production of the Wendt Center for Character Education at the University of Dubuque. I'm Annalee Ward, the director of the Wendt Center, and our guest today is Dr. Brian Halstos, Associate Professor of History. He is the author of the article, Diffusing Racism, Olympian Saul Butler's Serious Playfulness. I realize that you are listening to the podcast, but you may enjoy returning to look at the article as Dr. Halstos reads the old photos he's found, interpreting what might be lurking in the photo. And this article is available online at dbq.edu/went. That's dbq.edu/WENDT. Welcome, Dr. Halstos.
Thank you.
You wrote this article for the journal issue, Character and Play, and you focus on a University of Dubuque alum, Saul Butler, someone you discovered early on in your career here at UD. Would you help us get oriented with a little bit about who he was and why he was significant?
Saul Butler was a black man whose father had been enslaved, who was born into slavery. So he's one generation removed from the institution of slavery. His father was much older. Saul was born in 1895. And so I'm focusing on the time period during World War I when he came to college, which was a remarkable feat for pretty much anyone during that time period, but especially for African Americans. I think maybe in this article I reference the fact that it was more rare than someone who's black receiving a PhD today for someone at that period to enter college. And Saul Butler was an incredible all-around athlete, I think easily the greatest high school athlete during his period. He was one of the inaugural inductees into the High School Athletic Hall of Fame. And after college, just after college, went to the 1920 Olympics. Also at the end of college, he was a part of what was called the Army Olympics and was the greatest long jumper in the world at that point in time. In the 1920s, he's one of the few black players in the new NFL during that time before the league entirely segregated by the early 1930s. He played on all-black basketball teams, some of the great all-black basketball teams of the 20s. So just played baseball and track and field, just was a sprinter as well, was one of the elite sprinters in the country at that time as well. So phenomenal athlete who is under-recognized today.
Wow. That you just mentioned five sports. I mean, that is somebody who is amazing. It is high time we hear about this person. So just after World War I, college life was different back then. And you begin with the description of a activity, a club, the Philophronia Club and Jolly Parties. Could you talk to us about what that was? And just tell us a little bit more here.
Sure. The Philophronia Club was the oldest campus organization. I don't remember exactly when it started, but I want to say maybe as early as the 1870s. UD had started in the early 1850s. And it was a literary organization that would bring, at that point, both young men and women together, because this is some of the early years when women started to attend UD classes. They'd started attending classes a few years before Saul came to campus, and about the time he left, they had the first women's dorm. So it was young men and women coming together to read and write and mostly have fun together. And what was remarkable about this club and other organizations that Saul was involved in was that he and his brother, Ben, were the only black students in college at that point. And it was an interracial organization. And it's very rare at that point in history for black men and women to participate in predominantly white organizations and clubs during that time. I mean, there are other Black men and women who are attending predominantly white schools, or what we now call predominantly white institutions and schools, but usually they were excluded from these social cultural organizations. So it's a source of pride to know we're at an institution where, you know, that's part of our history, you know, that this is a place where he was not excluded, where he not only could attend classes, but lived in the dorms here on campus as well, which is very rare, because at, you know, down the road at University of Iowa, Black students were excluded from the dorms until after, you know, the World War II era, so decades later. And so it's something different is happening here than in most places around the country.
I think we're going to have to do another podcast to talk about what that difference is and explore that. But in this club, let's get back to this paper. Yep. In this club, you mentioned something called jolly parties. What is a jolly party?
Well, my understanding from the little that we have is it's a time to have some fun. I mean, the one I describe in the paper, they've come together to the women are observing the men take on what was, you know, at that time seen as part of a women's sphere, you know, doing things or working in the kitchen and cooking food or whatnot. So they've come together in Severance Hall, which is one of, at that time was a dormitory. Today it's one of our, where our office is at. That's where my office is at. But they're in the main lobby, and they've come together to watch the young men try to prepare food and try to clean and try to do some of the things that are supposed to be kind of seen in women's sphere. And it was during a time when they were also, you know, raising awareness about the fact that women were pushing for the vote. And so it was a way of showing some kind of, you know, solidarity, you know, the men and the women coming to get together. But Saul, during this event, doesn't perform so well. And they it's written about this in the yearbooks that he doesn't outcompete his another friend who is, I think, cooking a meal, or I forget exactly what all the activities were. I address as sewing, that's what, yes. And so just kind of a fun activity for men and women to get together and enjoy each other's camaraderie in a safe and warm space they had a record player, and we get some of these details in the yearbooks about what this space would be like. If you go there now, it still maintains some of the character of back then. You can kind of imagine being in this space and with friends, both men and women.
And what's remarkable about that is Saul Butler is here having fun, goofing off, and I think you had a picture in there that you talk about, with friends, and race does not seem to be an issue.
Right.
Early 1900s, 1920 about, something like that.
This would be the late teens here. And it's remarkable too, because he's doing something kind of in the domestic sphere, and men and women together, young adults. You know, my reading of it is that it's, you know, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, here he is, someone who is kind of demonstrating like his, you know, it's young men and women together and across race, where in much of the country you would not see a white woman with a Black man. That was dangerous territory for Black men in this country at that time. And just, you know, some of the most horrific things happened in that kind of dynamic. And here we see in this playful space that they're just having fun, and he feels, well, I guess we don't know exactly what he's feeling, but it seems that he felt comfortable to be engaged and playful and have a good time with them, you know.
So how did that carry over to his peers? Maybe not females so much, because so many of the pictures that you look at are Butler with his male companions, I think. And they look awfully happy. They look awfully formal, but informal in the way they're playing around. And I was just wondering, what do these photos tell you about play and community and character?
Right. Yes. And I mean, I think that's a good way of putting it, both formal and informal at the same time. And in so many of these photographs, we see Saul and his comrades wearing full dress. I mean, the kind of stuff that today we'd just wear if we're going to church, but these were worn much more often during that time.
What do the photos show you about how Butler got along with his white peers in terms of community and character building, if there was such a thing?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, he came in, you know, he's a phenomenal athlete. Everyone knew that, and that was widely known at that time. But I argue, and I think that's something that's not seen widely, is that his being a great athlete was not enough. You know, there's something else that's taking place, that that it was other things that he did. It was his character, it was his personalities, his ability to socialize and engage people across racial and cultural lines that was essential to his staying in the game and being able to play on the fields. And so I see playfulness as being one of those strategies, whether it was at a conscious level or not. I mean, his ability to engage people in playfulness that made it possible for him to, again, stay in the game, to form the bonds you need to have on a team where people trust you and will see you as a leader and will defer to your judgment. And it was necessary. He was the quarterback. I didn't mention this before, but he was probably, according to Arthur Ashe, the great tennis great and historian, says he probably was the first, or he says he was the first black quarterback to quarterback on a team for all 4 years. So coming in his first year, he was the leader of the team. And so I say that it's important. When we look at these photographs here, we see that they are embracing him and have their arms on his shoulders. And we see that in many more images than just the ones we have in the article here. There's a couple images in the piece that show him wearing a top hat and a sport coat and the vest and a tie. And in addition to that, even a monocle in his eye. And when you see it, it's clear that he's being playful, he's being silly, he's mocking pretensions. You know, he has his chin up, or he's looking like someone who's, you know, lost in thought, or maybe, you know, sees themselves as better than others because of their knowledge and learning or whatnot. One is by himself, the other one shows him among buddies here. And we see that he's comfortable, you know, connecting through humor and playfulness with them. Another photo in this part of the article shows him among some other teammates. They look almost like they may have been wrestling on the ground, and then they pose for a photo together. And it looks like a couple of them have their arms on his back and look almost like kid brothers, like they're, you know, the kind of, but knowing Saul and knowing that he wouldn't tolerate being he would have pushed them off if it had been offensive to him at that time. But I think that it just, the playfulness was a tool that he had for, that was helped him be connected and form these bonds and help people, as I go on and argue, help people see beyond their prejudices they may have brought into the campus, that see him as a full person and look beyond the stereotypes that were so rampant at that period.
We might ask the question about prejudice. I mean, it is obvious that racism is a problem in this country and has been, but if this school was admitting two blacks, which isn't very many, but it was two, was there a lot of prejudice that we are not aware of on this campus? Were they the only two minorities?
They were not the only two minorities. They were the only two black college students. There's evidence that there might have been at least one black student in the high school, or they had another school that was younger students were attending at UD at that time. But there, it was a very diverse and purposefully diverse campus during that time. And so it was actually the emphasis on training young men and eventually young women, but focusing, you know, on young men to go on to become pastors or church leaders, and especially people from outside of the U.S., from other countries. I mean, it was a very diverse place where it actually, in terms of the levels of diversity, it was one of the most diverse places internationally and you know, with foreign students that you'd find around the country at that time. We had students from Asia and from Eastern Europe and from Latin America and from, I mean, just some of the Hungary and the Philippines and from Cuba and from Mexico. And so I think that was part of the reason that when the Butlers came here, Saul and his brother Ben, it was a more welcoming place because there were other students who were not embracing white supremacy and not embracing some of the things that you'd find at most other campuses during this time when white supremacy was so prevalent and racism was so explicit during that time period. So I think they were, Butler and his parents and whoever went into making this choice were very intentional about finding a place where he would be welcome and could make his way. Now, it's not to say that there wasn't, I mean, there probably were things that took place that we just no longer have access to that didn't show up in the yearbooks, didn't show up in the images, weren't passed down through oral history.
You do mention that there are limits to playfulness. And I think one of the examples I see is you talk about minstrelsy. Tell us about that. Was that here on campus?
There was blackface minstrelsy here on campus, and I discussed that in one of the sections here in the essay, where Saul is actually part of this minstrel troupe. And just to, you know, just to maybe a little background about minstrelsy, blackface minstrelsy was America's first mass culture, I mean, mass entertainment that was extremely popular around the whole country through the 19th century, starting about 1830s and going forward. Initially, individuals performing in blackface and performing in ways that ridiculed black people and tried to, you know, affect what they saw as the, you know, southern black poor enslaved person. So through the raggedy clothes they wore and the malapropisms, the slaughtering the English language and whatnot for comedic effect. And then it became groups of people, these troupes that would perform and travel around the country. And even during the 19-teens and into the 1920s, blackface minstrelsy was very popular, especially across the North, where oftentimes troops, blackface minstrel troops would come into communities that maybe had few, if any, black residents in the community. So these kind of messages that were sent might stand in for, well, this is who black people are. This is how they act or whatnot. There's a couple photos showing Saul participating in a minstrel troupe. And it's difficult. We can't know exactly what he thought at that time or what all the meanings were at that place and time. But he's on stage with people who he cared for and cared for him deeply. And so it's complicated. And even though they're probably doing, you know, in their performance, we don't have the details of their performance. We know that they were considered funny because of some of the write-ups in the yearbooks, but they probably were doing many things that you'd see in other blackface productions and ridiculing black people and ridiculing, you know, denigrating blackness and African-Americans. So he participates in this. He had participated in blackface in high school as well. It's very complicated. In high school, he performed mostly with other black students and primarily to all black audiences or predominantly black audiences. And there's lots been written about minstrelsy and how sometimes black performers performing to black audiences, that they are, you know, that something else is going on than just denigration or in place of denigration, that oftentimes they might be making fun of white practices or, you know, there might be subtle barbs that are, you know, in their performance here. But here is an example of playfulness that, at least to my eye, and I think to others, that it seems, on balance, even though it might be endearing him with his classmates in this context, is also denigrating, you know, his African-American culture and history and participating in this harmful practice.
Did you ever see any evidence of violence in the play that Saul and his peers took part in?
Well, there's lots of violence taking place on the fields of play, yeah. Just because he's playing football and other sports. And one thing that doesn't appear in the yearbooks, just a real quickly here, that it was likely that Saul was the target of extra violence on the playing fields, where he would get shoulders and stepped on by metal cleats or things that we have learned about from some other black players who played on predominantly white teams or against other white teams that were subject to you know, physical violence on the playing fields. It's just that we don't have records of that, but I mean, it's almost certainly was the case. But yes, in terms of what we do have a record of, there was a tradition, a ritual where the freshman class would abduct seniors, members of the senior class who are about to graduate, and would rush them off somewhere. And then it was up to the junior class, members of the junior class, to go find the seniors who've been abducted and to free them and bring them back home. So there's something, you know, that had already been established, this tradition, but the way it played out with, in Saul's case, it seems like there's a side to it that's, that there's implied or a veiled threat, or it's, and so what took place in Saul's case is he was abducted early one morning coming down the steps and was tied up and gagged and thrown into a car and was even shackled. His ankles were shackled and was taken off to out of town, to a few miles out of town. And some other seniors were abducted as well. But from what the information we have, and there's at least three different places where this has been written about, two yearbooks and then a newspaper article, it suggests that he was treated differently. I mean, for one thing, I haven't come across anywhere where anyone else was shackled. And here, just to remind you that Saul is, you know, his father had been enslaved. I mean, he was someone who had escaped slavery. And so this has a different, you know, this idea of being shackled and tied up, something else is going on. And we get from one account where Saul actually gave someone, when he was freed from his shackles or whatnot, punched one of the freshmen and gave him a bruised eye, and the freshmen are thrown into this water. But what's especially menacing to me, or just chilling, is an account that comes a couple of years after the event. It's from a yearbook from a year or two after Saul's even left the college, from one of those freshmen who's writing about that story. Apparently, it made a big impression on people to the extent where they're writing about it, you know, years after the fact. And this student, he's unnamed in the yearbook article, talks about how, well, we made a promise not to physically harm Saul because he was our celebrated athlete who was about to go to the military Olympics overseas in Paris. But if it wasn't for that, and I forget the exact verbiage, but he says something to the effect, like his countenance, his physiognomy, his, you know, his face probably would have shown the impress of our violence, you know, something to suggest they would have harmed him, you know, if not for the fact that they had already sworn not to harm him. And just at that time period, this is, you know, when this took place in the late teens, it was right when after World War I had ended. It's, you know, around the time of the bloody summer, the Red Summer of 1919, when hundreds, you know, of African-Americans were the victims of racial violence, you know, coming back from World War I, had served in World War I, expecting maybe a little greater freedom. And there's tremendous white-black backlash, and Black people are killed just for wearing their uniforms around the country. I mean, just, it's a time period when lynching was not uncommon, and was a, you know, this very bloody, gruesome reminder of, you know, racial terrorism that's sending these messages to people around the country. So when you hear that kind of statement, and understand what's going on at the time, place, it just, it's chilling.
So we know that Saul Butler walked a fine line. He had that reality of the broader culture, and yet was able to build a place of community and camaraderie and respect. I mean, he was a unique individual, certainly groundbreaking. And this is just an essay I highly recommend for others to go back and read carefully. Brian, you have an intriguing interpretation here of the place of play, and you pushed us to recognize the ambiguities in that. And I'd like to say, is there any final words you'd like to say? Any?
Maybe just really briefly that he was a phenomenal athlete, but I think his, you know, his charisma and his social awareness and his ability to communicate across cultural lines was equally phenomenal and unique. I think that's really, you really need to look at him beyond just him being a great athlete. Like you mentioned, he's walking a fine line, and that took a lot of skill. I mean, we have to, you know, recognize the role his parents played, and I maybe address that, you know, a bit here, elsewhere too.
And Dr. Hostos has been very modest here because he has a book coming out titled
Jumping Past Jim Crow, The Mobile Life a black sport entrepreneur, Sal Butler.
This is a book that is forthcoming. Keep your eye out for it. You'll want to learn more about Sal Butler. Our guest today has been Dr. Brian Halstos, Associate Professor of History, and I'm Annalee Ward for Character Explorations from the Wendt Center for Character Education at the University of Dubuque.